Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Before we start our show today, I wanted to take a moment to remember a dear friend who died yesterday afternoon, Diane Nowicki, who was a poet and playwright, an ardent activist, hiker, an advocate for nature, and a very dear friend. We're going to miss her. Over the past few years, a flurry of LNG and methanol projects have been proposed for the Northwest communities from Vancouver, BC to Coos Bay, Oregon. There is a glut of natural gas being produced, and these LNG facilities and methanol refineries are the fossil fuel industry's way to get all this natural gas to market. But why is gas so abundant, and where is it coming from? The short answer is fracking, a reality that the gas industry does not want to emphasize as they continue to promote natural gas as a green alternative to coal and oil. Today we talk with Sandra Steingraber, an environmental writer, research biologist, and anti-fracking activist who lives atop the Marcellus Shale in upstate New York, one of the first regions to feel the impacts of fracking. We'll talk about why fracking is so destructive to our watersheds and communities and how people are successfully organizing to stop this brutal assault on the earth. Sandra, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I wanted to start by talking about how all that natural gas came to be stored under the ground where you live, as well as in many parts of the United States, from Texas to North Dakota and up in Canada and Alberta and Northeast British Columbia.
Many parts of North America have bedrock that represents the bottom of ancient oceans. The Marcellus Shale is the name of that ocean floor that is the bedrock in the northeast part of North America where I live. It extends from the Finger Lakes region of upstate New York, which is my home, so I would have lived on the north bank of this ancient sea 400 million years ago, and it would have gone all the way down to West Virginia. The east bank would have been where the Catskill Mountains are now, and then extending all the way into eastern Ohio. And similar shallow oceans overlay other parts of our nation, including the Dakotas, and including parts of Texas, and so on. And each one of these are referred to as the industry as a shale play, because inside this rock is trapped the corpses of marine animals that lived in those oceans during the Devonian Age. And we're talking about animals that are not fish, and sea creatures that we know now, because this was back before 3 and 4 chambered hearts, before eyeballs and backbones and fins and scales and so on. So we're talking about things like diatoms, sea lilies, and squid. And so when these creatures died, of course, their bodies sank to the floor, as ocean creatures do. But because the Earth's atmosphere had less oxygen in it than it does now, there weren't a lot of land plants yet, there was less oxygen in these oceans. And so these ancient creatures, when they died, did not decompose the way they would now, but rather turned into bubbles of methane, which is the chemical name for natural gas. It's a carbon with 4 hydrogens around it. And then depending on the conditions of the sea, some of these guys became bubbles of propane or butane or ethane or heavier molecular weight substances such as oil. But the point being that all of these hydrocarbon corpses, these bodies in this ancient cemetery, are actually trapped inside the rock. And until fracking came along, there was no real way to get it out. But instead, what oil and gas extraction operators looked for were places in the earth where there were faults and folds, and that those bubbles had escaped and formed big balloons under the earth. And then they could stick a straw down, you know, and up came the bubble in crude or a gas well. But we've burned through a lot of that now. And the question before us is whether or not it's time to retire the fossil fuel party or blow up our bedrock using drinking water as the club to extract these tiny bubbles that are trapped inside the rock. And obviously we are right now pursuing the latter option. And so suddenly North America, instead of running out of natural gas and being concerned about how we might import it, is now becoming a net exporter of oil and gas, and thus these liquefied natural gas terminals, as the Northwest is facing, are starting to be sited all over our coastline. In other words, fracking is a kind of an octopus on the surface of the earth, because it spreads its tentacles far beyond the shale plays where the gas and oil are actually extracted. There have to be compressor stations to compress the gas and push it through hundreds and hundreds of miles of pipeline, which have to be laid, and then to carry it across the ocean to export markets such as China or the European Union. Then the gas has to be liquefied through a process of cryogenics. It has to be made super chilled, liquefied, and put on ships that are virtual pipelines. And this now, this fracking boom has created an energy upheaval that has kind of changed the whole geostrategic game as well. Energy dominance is now part of the current administration's plan. And even what's happening today, as we watch this unprecedented summit in Helsinki, pipelines, gas, oil, that's all part of what, it's all wrapped up together now. So this is a huge moment.
Well, I want to get back a little bit to this kind of shift when natural gas was actually seen back in the, maybe 20 years ago, as a bridge fuel to get us from the fossil fuel past to the renewable fuel future. And at that time, natural gas was being touted as much cleaner burning than coal or even oil, and much more accessible as a source than solar or wind was seen back at that time. What's your thought about how realistic was that back in the early 90s, and also what has shifted since the early 90s that's put natural gas in a very different kind of focus now?
Well, this bridge metaphor, that somehow natural gas is kind of the cleanest of this unholy trinity of fossil fuels, coal, oil, and gas, was always part of an industry talking point. And there wasn't a lot of pushback right away against the bridge metaphor and questioning the assumptions about whether or not we could skate along on gas until renewables were scaled up enough to deploy. There wasn't a lot of science to that. I mean, maybe natural gas is a gangplank. Maybe it's a terrible detour. Maybe it's an off-ramp to a renewable energy future. I mean, there's lots of metaphors you could imagine, right? But we didn't have good data on the leakage rate of natural gas. So let me then now kind of unpack this a little bit, and I'm going to get all sciencey and nerdy for a minute.
That's okay.
So when we burn fossil fuels, they all contribute carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. And of course, carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas, meaning that when it's in the atmosphere, the bonds that hold this molecule together will vibrate when thermal radiation, which is what we call heat, strikes it. So at the end of the day, when the warmth from the sun bounces off the Earth's surface and tries to escape back into outer space, some of it can't do it. Some of it's trapped because it hits these molecules of greenhouse gases like CO2, carbon dioxide, which then start to dance in this vibrational way, and that keeps heat inside of our atmosphere. That means that every time the Earth turns away from the sun every night, our blood plasma doesn't freeze solid, the oceans don't become ice skating rinks, life can go on. It gets a little cooler at night, but not a whole lot cooler, right? And so life can abide and survive the night because we have this blanket of vibrating, dancing greenhouse gas molecules up in the atmosphere, which represents, in a large part, the exhaled breath of all living things. And carbon dioxide actually lasts for 100 years before that molecule falls apart. So it's interesting to think about that your exhaled breath which is changing the atmosphere, the chemistry by virtue of you being alive and metabolizing, it's going to outlive you. You're going to be dead and gone. And your breathing is going to go on and provide a blanket for other living things to come after you to keep them all warm at night and allow them to live. So living things provide the conditions for other living things to live in the future. It's kind of cool. But when we add to that all that exhaled breathing, the carbon dioxide from burning lots of fossil fuels, we have now increased the level of carbon dioxide in our atmosphere by almost 40%. And that means it's a blanket we can't kick off at night with the consequence of climate change, right? Melting ice caps, worse storms, lack of water availability, pollination problems, all the things we could talk about that threaten human civilization itself now. We call it an existential crisis because it is actually threatening human existence as we know it. All right. But it turns out that even though carbon dioxide is the most well-known of the greenhouse gases, carbon actually comes in two flavors. And the other form of carbon is methane. So when we say we have to decarbonize or get rid of the carbon or have a carbon tax, we're not just talking about carbon dioxide. Carbon is not the first name of carbon dioxide. It also refers to methane, which is carbon with four hydrogens around it. And it, too, vibrates when struck with heat and will help hold the heat in at night, which is a good thing. And methane naturally occurs and goes up into the atmosphere. But when we extract oil, gas, and coal, the methane that's trapped along with it leaks out and enters the atmosphere. So we have actually increased the amount of methane in our atmosphere, not by 40% like we have with carbon dioxide, but we've almost tripled it since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. And the problem with methane is that it's very potent at trapping gas. It does trapping heat. It does a better job than carbon dioxide. It is actually 86 times more powerful in about over a couple decades time frame at trapping heat. The only good thing we can say about this is that that methane doesn't last as long in the atmosphere. It doesn't last for 100 years. It lasts for about a decade. But we're at the point of the climate crisis now where we don't have more than a decade or two left to solve the problem. So we can't just build a bridge that lowers our CO2 but increases our methane levels, because we're going to go off the cliff in the amount of time left available to us. In other words, we have to bring methane down along with CO2. So what we did not have good data on 20 years ago, now I'm actually answering your question after I've set it all up this way, what we did not have good data on when fracking got started is how much methane leaks from the whole operation from the moment the drill bit digs into the shale, and we haven't even laid the pipe yet, but, you know, up comes the methane vapor out of the dark heart of the planet and into the atmosphere. Then it leaks all along the pipeline. It leaks from compressor stations and flare stacks and from the burner tips and from the pipelines underlying our cities and our furnaces. Every time we liquefy it to make an LNG terminal, every time we regasify it, once we get it to market, and so on. And if you add up all those leaks, we now have some pretty good data showing that it's no better than coal, and it could possibly be worse. So it's basically a lateral move or maybe a backwards move, but it's not a bridge to anywhere that we want to go. In the meantime, what we also didn't know 20 years ago is how quickly renewables could be scaled up and how the technology could be improved. So we're now at a point where a natural gas power plant, for example, in other words, building pipes to go to an oven where we're going to light natural gas on fire in order to generate electricity, that is so efficient and the return on investment so long into the future that wind and solar are rapidly undercutting it. The only holdout argument for a while was that we needed these so-called peaker plants with natural gas in order to provide electricity during peak demand or when the sun wasn't shining and the wind wasn't blowing. But now we have battery storage that is poised to make it far more efficient and far quicker to provide electricity during peak demand and outperform both in terms of efficiency and in terms of economics anything that gas can do. In other words, renewables can now do anything gas can do and do it better. So it's no longer the case that natural gas is a bridge to anywhere we want to go for two reasons. One is because we now know, it leaks a lot of more methane than we realized, and methane is a much more potent greenhouse gas than we knew, and we also don't have time to let that play out. And second, because renewables have filled in what we need them to do far more rapidly than we predicted. So that argument is scientifically wrong, economically wrong, and it's just no longer true.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And today we're talking about fracking with Sandra Steingraber, an environmental writer, research biologist, and anti-fracking activist. Well, last month I had an opportunity to talk with a couple people from the Port of Tacoma, which is trying very hard to get a very complex LNG facility on board that would be run by Puget Sound Energy. And they are building an 800 million gallon tank without a permit right now on the port facility to store this natural gas, or to store LNG, actually. And I gave them some of the arguments that you've made about why people are opposing this LNG facility. And their argument back, I mean, there were a couple things. I found it interesting that there's one guy in particular who is a big methanol backer and a big LNG backer. He thinks fracking is horrible. But he feels that it's important that in the meantime, until we have all the renewables online, that we need to take the opportunity to be a leader in LNG in this region so that somebody else doesn't do it, basically. And the other thing I found interesting when I talked about how one of the permits is being, there's an effort to try to get a supplemental environmental impact statement for this facility, and the urge in that would be to have a cradle-to-grave analysis of the carbon emissions. And he's saying that he thinks that that's wrong because you shouldn't be considering the impacts in other parts of the world for a local facility. So I'm wondering what your response would be if you had an opportunity to talk to this guy from the Tacoma port.
Well, he's not operating on good data. So, I mean, people can be blinded by dollar signs. But even so, I mean, the economic of LNG facilities that are looking grimmer and grimmer every day. The return on investment for these things. First of all, they're some of the most capital-intense infrastructure projects that we know, and the return on investment approaches 30 to 40 years. All the economic analyses I've read suggest that these things have a very strong chance of just becoming stranded assets. In other words, that their renewables are clipping along at such a rate that the return on investment is never going to be paid off, and these things just become these giant white elephants. As for worried only about carbon emissions in local areas as opposed to globally, there's no point to that. I mean, that's like worrying about, sitting in the smoking section and sitting in the non-smoking section. I mean, we're all in the same plane. There's no safe way to have a smoking section in an airplane. Can't be done. And if you release carbon dioxide or methane at any point, there's no fences up there. It's not like we're going to keep that out of our atmosphere and only keep it in China's atmosphere. The prevailing winds blow from east to west, and so anything that's released into the atmosphere, diffusion takes it everywhere. So I feel like most seventh graders could explain diffusion and how we're all connected by atmosphere.
Well, what really sort of strikes me when I talk to these people is that it seems like fracking is a dirty word everywhere. I mean, and the Port of Tacoma, which is largely, its livelihood is largely based on fossil fuel. There's a bunch of different companies that work out of there that do, there's an oil refinery, U.S. Oil. There's Targa, which has huge gas tanks. And now they want this LNG facility. But it seems that they they don't want to support fracking, and yet they seem to peel away the reality that LNG or methanol or any of these other projects they want to bring to the Northwest are based on a process which is, or at least half the gas in this region now is coming from fracking, if not more. Do you have any thoughts about how people can compartmentalize their thinking? And I guess actually the first part of my question is, do you feel some success that fracking is now a dirty word at the Port of Tacoma? And then the frustration of the fact that even though people don't want to support fracking vocally, they are in fact by the business practices that they're promoting.
Well, look, I'm not in the business of trying to change the minds of those who've got their money invested in this. I'm interested in bringing good science to those who are resisting and fighting these projects. Here in New York State, we just celebrated a great victory this week. We spent 8 years fighting a Houston-based oil and gas company called Crestwood, which is what's called a midstream company, meaning they're one of the biggest in the nation at storing and transporting natural gas from the gas fields to the burner tip or wherever the market might be. They came into our rural Finger Lakes upstate New York region, purchased 5 miles of prime lakefront property on our beloved Seneca Lake, which is a source of drinking water for 100,000 people. It's also the center for our winery, so we like to say that's the lake that turns water into wine. It's such a deep lake, it creates its own microclimate and makes it possible to grow beautiful Riesling grapes and Cabernet Franc, and I'll just throw those words around because I know that Oregon is a place where people know wine. And that's the economic goose that lays our golden egg here. And so this company was not interested in any of that. They were primarily interested in getting their hands on these holes in the ground underneath the lake and on the lake shore that were left over from a century of salt mining. And so these old salt caverns were free gas tanks for this Houston-based company where it could store not just methane but also butane, which is cigarette lighter fluid, and propane until it got the price it wanted before it shoved it into pipelines and took it to distant markets. So none of this was intended for us, but we were going to take all the risk and have none of the benefits, the economic benefits that the company itself would accrue. So there was a remarkable campaign that ran for years and years here. It involved wine business leaders organizing. It involved people who had summer homes organizing. It involved some civil disobedience that I was part of, that were 650 people were arrested trying to block the gates. It went on for a long time, but we have prevailed. This company voluntarily ended its methane storage, and just this week we learned that our state Department of Environmental Conservation is now denying the permit to store LPG, liquefied petroleum gases, on the grounds that it would profoundly alter the character and the ecology of this community, because you can't have underground storage without pipelines, compressor stations, flare stacks, and mass industrialization. And so we're really pleased with this decision. It shouldn't have to be that hard to get the government to stand up for the citizens instead of these rapacious out-of-state companies who simply see the bedrock as something to blow up to bring a hydrocarbon to market in the middle of a climate emergency. But I just want to say that we won. And it was a combination of people who cared so deeply they were willing to go to jail for this, some really good science, some really good attorneys, and a mass political movement. And we just built grassroots political power. So the reason fracking is a dirty word, and the reason that what's going to happen very soon is that things like peaker plants and LNG facilities are going to be seen like investing in the whale oil industry, is because of good science and really powerful activism that changes the narrative and says we are at this moment where the past, the ruinous past that is bringing us to the point of destruction with climate change, this ruinous dependency on fossil fuels, is the dead end. And then we have this other way forward, which is to pursue a full-bore affair with renewable energies. They're not the future. They're now. We have all the technology we need, and we have good data to show that. And so we need to change the narrative, and we do that by building political power as communities. And those of us who are in science have an obligation, I believe, to take that message and go tell it on the mountain about the science to our elected officials, to our faith leaders, to our local officials. And there will be people who simply dig in and hang on. But there were those people when we decided we're not smoking on airplanes either. I'm old enough to remember when people said, you can't ban smoking on airplanes. The pilots will have a nicotine crisis and it will be completely unsafe. You know, I mean, there were like these nutsy arguments, but this too shall pass. I truly believe that.
No, actually, I'm trying to think. I think the last time I heard you speak that this getting rid of this plan around Lake Seneca was not a done deal yet, and it seemed like you were still fighting it, and that was only like 2 months ago. Is that true?
Yeah, that's right. We just, it became a done deal about 5 days ago.
It's really good to hear. I'd like to be able to follow stories and watch the progression because, and after, in a little bit, we can get to the other big fight that you had in New York State, which was, I think you've banned fracking in the state now. Is that true?
Yes, we did.
I'm kind of interested in comparing the two struggles. I mean, was it easier to ban fracking than it was to stop this company from coming in and destroying your lake?
Well, I think all campaigns have their own, you know, hard places and their own moments of clarity. I think we had, in terms of banning fracking, I think that what was clear to us is that we had one target, and that was our Governor Cuomo, who could make this decision. He came into office after a previous governor who had to resign under a cloud of scandal did an amazingly good thing, which was to sign an executive order that was a moratorium on fracking that basically said, we're going to hit the pause button and study it and look at the public health impacts and the environmental impacts before we go forward. And so our current governor took that seriously, and we began this process of discernment and a lot of deliberation. And so I felt the weight of responsibility as an ecologist who can throw myself into the data, you know, if there's a political moment where we're all thinking about whether to move forward or not, I can bring some really good data to that moment. So my role, my primary role in New Yorkers Against Fracking, which is a statewide coalition of many, many groups that sprang up, my role was to really be the scientist in residence to that movement, and along with some other amazing scientists who organized themselves as New York Concerned Health Professionals of New York. And there was another group we worked closely with, physicians, scientists, and engineers for healthy energy. And so we began to review the data, analyze the data, compile it. And when we finally banned fracking, there were 400 studies in the peer-reviewed literature, and almost all of them that looked for risks and harms of fracking found them. Now there are more than 1,200 such studies, so the data has increased by a factor of 3, and it's shown the wisdom of the governor's decision to ban it. So in other words, the governor banned it with the courage that the preliminary evidence showed signs of harm, and the evidence that's come in subsequently has shown that it was as bad as we thought it was, and in some cases we've discovered additional problems. So Concerned Health Professionals of New York is still a shop that exists, and we continue to update this compendium of peer-reviewed studies. And for those who are fighting fracking or infrastructure, such as LNG facilities, we have reviewed all the science on those too. And so I commend you. It's got the most unsexy title ever. The Compendium of Scientific, Medical, and Media Findings Demonstrating the Risks and Harms of Unconventional Gas and Oil Extraction. The fifth edition was released this spring. I know that people can't write that down quickly, but if you simply Google our name, Concerned Health Professionals of New York, you will find our study, which is a peer-reviewed study that's open access, freely available for download. And we wrote it four folks. We translated the science into plain spoken English. It's divided up into all kinds of different themes and cross-referenced topics. So you can, if you're just interested in, for example, compressor stations or LNG facilities or air pollution or earthquakes, you can easily search it. And so Concerned Health Professionals of New York, take a look and use it for your own campaigns. Use it to educate yourselves, your neighbors, your elected officials, and so on.
Well, if you can send me that link after the show, then I'll put it on our website later today.
Absolutely.
And you're listening to Locus Focus here on Kiwoo Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And today we're talking about fracking with Sandra Steingraber, an environmental writer, research biologist, and anti-fracking activist. Well, as you're talking about the research that you've compiled and all the work that science professionals have done to really help the movement to stop fracking in New York State, I'm thinking about all these people that I've been meeting in the project that I'm working on right now, which is about the push to build methanol and LNG facilities all around the Northwest, that there's amazing non-professional science individuals who've just like educated themselves with the help of some scientists in the community and have done amazing work at pulling together studies, at finding, getting public document releases, and writing very powerful comments to stop the methanol refineries that are being proposed in Kalama, Washington, and across the river at Port Westward, Oregon, and the LNG facility in Tacoma. And I wonder if you have any advice to community members who want to take on the scientific studies themselves.
Well, yeah, I mean, you don't have to invent the wheel. Hopefully the compendium gives you a good head start, and physician scientists and engineers, PSE for Healthy Energy, also has an amazing online database of all these studies. So that work is there for you. Public comments are very powerful, as we learned in banning fracking in New York. So when people feel that they know something about an LNG facility or they know something about fracking, the more they know, the more opposed, the more reasons they can see why this is wrong. It's basically cashing out a resource that could be sustainable, like an estuary or a fish nursery, in our case, a freshwater lake, and putting it at peril. For it brings temporary profits to a few and permanent ruin for many. That's kind of the risk of all of these projects. And so once people are armed with some science, they feel empowered to write comments. They feel empowered to stand up at public hearings and say something. Some of the most powerful comments I heard were, for example, from a beekeeper who found out that one of the air pollutants that's commonly associated with fracking is one that he knew very well interfered with the ability of bees to navigate and find flowers. So he was able to make that connection. Mothers of children with asthma made a different argument. People of faith and our faith leaders taking a look at climate change from a human rights and a moral and ethical position had another kind of argument, but it became so powerful, and we ultimately directed almost 250,000 comments to Albany over the course of all these years of fighting. No other issue had ever brought so much public participation, and that was part of our power. And in so doing, with all these people speaking, basically you took the social license of these companies away. And then people, of course, if we're going to say no to fracking, immediately want to know, well, what can we say yes to? So when Crestwood was menacing Seneca Lake in the heart of wine country, and the wineries organized, they realized that we should really all go solar. And they did that. A lot of them did that. So some people are really interested in pursuing the good and alternative solutions and deploying those as fast as possible, while other people are better suited to kind of help bar the door and say no and deny permits to the fossil fuel project. So it's really a two-fisted fight, and nobody's perfectly positioned to play both games. I'm a pretty good organic chemist, and I know a lot of public health, and I know the climate science pretty well, so I'm better suited to be the critic for more fossil fuel build-out. Some of my brothers and sisters in the movement know a whole lot about community-based grids and fee and tariffs and things that are make it possible to deploy renewables in a way that really benefits communities. And that's a whole set of physics and economics that I'm not as good at. But that's okay, because we're all part of this great human orchestra, and we're all playing our part. And I guess what I want to say to the people of Oregon is that we just won this massive victory, both against the fracking industry in general. Our bedrock here in New York remains unfractured, and we have a lot of methane under our feet, and we're leaving it in the ground. And we just chased away one of the biggest Goliaths of all from the shores of Seneca Lake. And in both cases, these guys show up wearing the mantle of inevitability, pretending that it's just absolutely a foregone conclusion that this is going to go, this project is going to go forward. And if you want a seat at the table, we can talk about regulations, but you can't just say no and be an obstructionist. And one of our arguments, and this was said so beautifully by one of our attorneys who worked really closely in the anti-fracking movement, was we don't want a seat at the table, your table, fossil fuel companies. We want to turn the table over and see teeth on the floor. So we were willing to say, not so fast. No is still our position. And asking for what you want is a very powerful thing. And if you can get there by bringing good science and public participation, then that's the best of all. And that's how we won fracking. But in the case of Crestwood, which was a little bit more of a complicated struggle because our state provided one set of permits, but the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission in Washington provided some of the others, so there were multiple targets here. We had exhausted the ability to provide science, because what we were told by the regulatory agencies is we're just not going to look at your data. So it was a kind of a last resort situation, and that's where civil disobedience and nonviolent direct action has a kind of time-honored American history can be. So, and we ended up in some ways running a kind of corporate campaign, because there were no more government agencies left who could say no. But if we could keep standing in the driveway so week after week, so that every time you Googled the name of this company, what popped up was, 93-year-old arrested on Crestwood's driveway, we were sending a really strong message, not only to our community, but to the shareholders and everyone who did business with Crestwood. And we think that's important.
Well, actually, I was Googling Puget Sound Energy a few weeks ago to kind of get a handle on the company. And the first thing that popped up turned out to be a spoof of their website, which is put together by a group called Redefine Tacoma, and also the Piala Water Warriors. And it just spells out, exactly in satirical terms what Puget Sound Energy is up to with this LNG facility. So that's, to me, one example of how you can kind of turn the tables.
Exactly.
And I guess the other thing that I'm concerned about with the big challenge is that a lot of these companies, particularly here in the Northwest, because we are conceived around the world as being a very green-conscious region, they all greenwash these projects. So whether it's the methanol facility that's being slated for Kalama, where the company is saying, well, this is going, if we make this methanol and we ship it to China and they use it to make olefin as a base for plastics, they won't be using coal. And so this is a really green proposal. And this is the Northwest helping China become more green. And the same thing with the LNG facility in Tacoma, where Puget Sound Energy is saying, this is going to clean up the air in the port of Tacoma, because the tote ships, the barges that go up to Alaska, will switch from this horrible bunker oil to LNG, which it burns much cleaner, and there won't be all the particulate matter that goes into the air and it hurts the longshoremen. So how do you counter those kind of arguments?
Well, it's a shell game, right? So and it's part of the playbook. I mean, we heard it here, too. If we would only allow fracking, we could bring natural gas into, Harlem instead of number two heating oil and so on. But look, you cannot blast methane out of the ground and turn it into LNG without all kinds of different emissions. And methane is one of them, and methane is a precursor for smog. And what makes LNG particularly bad is that the temperature that you have to draw methane to for it to liquefy is, you know, minus 200 and something degrees. It's super cold. And that's below the freezing point of other nasty chemicals like benzene. And so in order to create LNG, you have to distill this very carefully and get rid of the benzene. So, and that escapes into the atmosphere. So you end up, you may not have particulates, but you end up with what are called volatile organic chemicals in a big way with LNG. Further, the way LNG works for long-distance transport, in order to keep it cool, it relies on evaporative cooling, which means by design you have to vent methane and turn it from a liquid into a gas in order to keep the whole thing from blowing up. On top of all that, there are incredible security concerns. LNG is a potential terrorist target, requires huge commitment by coast guards in order to shepherd these ships in and out of harbors. Nothing else can move in and out or get close. So it interferes with other kinds of commerce and trade, and puts people at great security risk. So there's no reason to exchange one set of problems for another when renewables can do all this and do it better, and nobody's going to get blown up.
And that's another thing, I guess, that's really a concern, is that LNG is extremely explosive. And let's talk a bit about why it's so explosive.
Well, it's explosive because when you liquefy it, you reduce its volume by a huge amount, and that allows you to carry a lot of it on ships. But if it should warm up and move from a liquid phase back to a gas phase, it expands really quickly. So that's part of the reason. And it burns at a very high temperature, so it can actually melt things, including human flesh, at a quarter mile away. So if you have a pool of liquefied natural gas that ignites and it's floating around like a cloud, there's also no technology known to firefighting that can extinguish that. So it represents, there are unique hazards with LNG.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. We're talking today with fracking activist Sandra Steingraber, who's also an environmental writer, research biologist, and has written a book that's meant a lot to many of us called Living Downstream. Which was, you wrote that a number of years ago. I think I interviewed you after you wrote that book, actually. And I'm kind of wondering about the lineage from going through what you were concerned about back then when you wrote that to what you're fighting these days.
Sure. Well, it is all connected. So, my path to the kind of biology I practice began in a very autobiographical way. I was diagnosed with bladder cancer at the age of 20 in between my sophomore and junior year of college. It was my own diagnosing physician who asked me about my possible childhood exposures to certain kinds of chemicals. I was a young biology major anyway. I thought I was headed to medical school. I no longer wanted to do that because I knew as a bladder cancer patient that bladder cancer of all human cancers is the one most likely to recur, recurs in 50-70% of all patients, and I was going to be living a highly medicalized life and spending a lot of time in hospitals as a patient. I no longer wanted to be my workplace. So instead, I began gathering string on what we knew about toxic chemical exposures and cancer risk. And at the same time, the headlines of the day were all talking about a place called Love Canal, And so it was, which was a place in upstate New York near Buffalo where people and children had been exposed to chemicals that had been dumped years before and now had exposures and consequent health risks and so on. This was under the Carter administration. So my life took a different path, and I spent, a good 5 years in and out of hospitals, and then also decided to really look at environmental health. So jumping forward years later after I finished my PhD and had a kind of wonderful postdoctoral opportunity at Harvard Radcliffe, I moved back into my sister's basement in my hometown along the Illinois River, where I grew up, and became an environmental detective there, and did uncover the presence of bladder carcinogens in my hometown drinking water wells. And the story of how I did that then became the story of the book Living Downstream, which represents my best attempt as a biologist to summarize the evidence for a link between environmental exposures and cancer risks on the one hand, but interwoven with that scientific story is a very personal story about my hometown and how I discovered I was one data point in a cluster of cancers there, and how that happened and how it was covered up. So I argued in that book that instead of making toxic chemicals a consumer choice and encouraging people to avoid this and buy that instead of this, we should really take a human rights approach. And if there are chemicals linked to cancer, it should just not be part of our economy, that we should immediately prioritize phasing them out and finding non-toxic substitutes. And I thought that that was a real preventive approach. I had walked all the way upstream to the point where these chemicals are manufactured and said, let's just rethink this. This is bad design, bad engineering, bad chemistry. We can do better than that. Subsequent to Living Downstream, which originally was published in 1997, and then it was turned into a film, and then re-released with updated science in 2010. Subsequent to that, I began to see that toxic chemical reform isn't really possible, because a lot of what's driving the toxic chemical proliferation is the oil and gas industry. They're all petrochemicals, most of the things I worry about, and a lot of them are manufactured from the waste products left over from extraction from oil and gas. And just to give you one story of what's happening here in the East, the Pennsylvania bedrock is being blown up for methane, natural gas, and what comes out of the ground at the same time, especially in western Pennsylvania near Pittsburgh, is a lot of ethane. And ethane, unlike methane or butane or propane, isn't really a good fuel. So it doesn't really do much for the energy industry. But if you can put it in a pipeline and send it to Scotland, you can turn it into plastic. So ethane can be cracked into ethylene, and ethylene is the building block for all kinds of different things, but most notably single-use plastics. So here we are, worried about, not drinking plastic straws and not taking plastic bags from the supermarket, because our oceans are now so filled up with plastic that fish and marine mammals are basically starving from the inside out. There's more plastic in some columns of the ocean than there is plankton. Our oceans are dying because they're being choked with plastic, and we recognize this, but we're going to be getting lots more plastic because the energy industry can, as a value-added thing, offload it to the petrochemical industry cheaply and make more and more and more. So I've moved further upstream, and I'm no longer really focused on toxic chemical reform, because I want to go all the way to the point where the fossils are blasted out of the ground in the first place, and work as a scientist with the hashtag Keep It In The Ground movement, inspired by the promise of renewable energy solutions, which will also, I believe, help catalyze green chemistry and renewable solutions for our materials economy. So the intersectionality between toxic chemicals and energy is where I now cast my net.
And you talk about fracking as being a human rights issue. How do you see that?
Well, fracking can't be done without industrializing the surface of the earth. So that means it happens in all of our backyards. It happens in places where we grow our food. And it uses drinking water as the tool to smash the bedrock apart. And it necessarily generates massive amounts of toxic waste when that water comes back up out of the hole, and it is now contains not only all the chemicals of the fracking fluids, which are toxic, but things like benzene and uranium and lead and arsenic and all the naturally occurring toxic chemicals that are trapped deep under the ground. I mean, the Earth's crust contains a whole periodic chart of chemicals, including all kinds of heavy metals. As long as they're down there, they're natural, right? They're part of the periodic chart, but they're not normally part of the biological world at the sunlit surface of the Earth where we live. So when we turn the Earth inside out and blow it apart to extract bubbles of gas or oil, up come all these toxic chemicals inside the water that's now completely contaminated and can never again be fresh drinkable water. The technology does not exist to turn fracking fluid back into drinkable water. So now we have a huge toxic waste disposal problem. We necessarily have air pollution, and we've destroyed land for well pads. We fragmented habitat. We're building pipelines. We're putting in compressor stations, which are some of the loudest pieces of technology and some of the most air polluting. We're taking away the ability of communities to do other things. When you industrialize farmland, when you industrialize people's communities, you bring in temporary workers. You see things like violent victimization of women go up, rape, assault, drug charges, drunk driving charges. All these things happen when fracking companies arrive in communities with these temporary out-of-state workforces. And it especially happens in indigenous communities. So the disappearance and the sex trafficking of Native women, especially in North Dakota, where I'm actually going to be going on a fact-finding trip next month, is just stunning. And at the same time, you're kind of blowing up the bedrock to cash out these fossil fuels, leaving shards behind, leaving contaminated water behind. So there's a human rights problem called generational inequity, meaning that members of this generation profit from that, but we leave ruin and costs for the generations that follow to cope with, to suffer from, or to have to pay to clean up. So anytime somebody profits and somebody else suffers, there's a human rights problem.
So Sandra, we have about 30 seconds left. I want you to give us some hope. So let's get back to how activism works.
Well, therein is hope, right? Activism makes hope, makes the space for hope. So there's hope because science is on our side. There's hope because people are waking up, and all over the world, people are willing to put their bodies on the line if needed. Just this morning, I was following the story of a woman who went to court in North Yorkshire, England, in an attempt to stop fracking there. And here were all these people from York standing around outside the courthouse. I'm going to cry when I say this, playing guitar and singing Woody Guthrie's "This Land Is Your Land" in their Yorkshire accents. So here's Woody Guthrie, the son of Oklahoma, right, which is the heart of fracking. And his words and his music are inspiring people across the ocean. And so there's this great uprising of people now that recognize in this moment of climate emergency that in order to keep our atmosphere intact, we have to keep our bedrock intact. and human ingenuity in the form of, you know, solar, wind, battery powers. This is the iPhone of energy. This is the future, and that's where we can be moving. So all of these, all the stars are in alignment, and you don't want to miss this historical moment. You know, if you lived in Alabama in the 1950s, you wouldn't have wanted to miss Martin Luther King Jr. and the Alabama bus boycotts and the March to Selma. This is our Selma. This is our lunch counter right now, and there's a place for you in this orchestra. So join us. You feel better and happier, and your life becomes really meaningful when you're part of one of these campaigns.
Well, thanks a whole lot for joining us today, Sandra.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
And I hope we'll talk again soon. It's always good to talk to you.
Likewise.
So today we've been talking with Sandra Steingraber, an environmental activist, research biologist, and anti-fracking activist. And you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. If you're tuning in, if you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. Next week we'll talk with Fred Pierce, author of Fallout, Disasters, Lies, and the Legacy of the Nuclear Age. My engineer is Patsy Kohlberg. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Alan Toussaint. Thanks for listening.
Now is the time. Now is the time for all good men to get together with one another. Iron out their problems and iron out their quarrels and try to live as brothers. And try to find peace within without stepping on one another. And due respect to the women of the world, just remember we all had mothers.
Make this land a better land in the world in which we live.
And help each man be a better man with the kindness that you give. And I know we can make it.
I know that we can.
I know done well we can work it out.
Oh yes we can, I know we can, can. Yes we can. Why can't we if we want to? Yes we can.
I know we can make it work.
I know that we can.
I know we can make it if we try.
Oh, yes.